Okay, we are back. I think we're at episode 290. Joe, how you doing?
Well, actually, not well. I want to apologize for my voice tonight. I have had a cold, which I think I'm over, but then simultaneous attack by pollen.
Oh, fun.
You know, this is the first, I think, year in 20 years we've had rain in California, so all the plants have decided to bloom, and our, you know, the whole city is covered with this pollen dust, and everyone is having a bad reaction to it. So I'm, you know, just struggling through it, but good to hear your voice, brother. How's things by you?
Not too bad. Well, this week, we had a funny story. I think it's funny. Robin DiAngelo, the author of White Fragility, has advised Black Americans to get away from white people. She said this during a webinar hosted by Barrett Kohler Publishers. That was subsequently posted on YouTube by the Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism. A little irony, I suppose. DiAngelo, the author of several books teaching white people to hate themselves, has encouraged people of color to get away from white people and have some community with each other. Okay. DiAngelo's language sounds very much like the ideas behind separate but equal. But then again, she's not willing to give white people that same privilege to build their own community with each other, right? With this, I guess it's again it's diversity for you, I guess. But if you want to, I guess certain groups can have their own community, I guess.
Yeah, they have this idea that white people equal economic activity, and so we can't really ever be alone or by ourselves, because to do so would be to impede, you know, economic activity and access to people of color, right?
So she's admitting their parasitism then.
Yeah, and that in a sense, you know, but
it's tax, we're the tax base.
But you know, it's just an interesting idea to think of what would happen if they did encourage like white people to come together and just be by ourselves for a while. And discuss our world and our plight. And then they would ask, you know, the other ethnicities to do the same. It really produced some amazing analysis. I mean, just it'd be fascinating to listen to the different understandings of reality that, you know, white people would have, and it would express if there wasn't colored people and, you know, people of color in the room with them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It would just be fascinating to listen to how they would describe who they are, what they are, and how they could, you know, have a better life and things like that. And, you know, I've seen some studies, which are just self-evident, you know, that there is a kind of tension that people experience when they're, you know, in groups where there's multi-ethnic components, right?
Yes.
And when people are, you know, in kind of a tribe, then they just have a more solid psychological base, you know, for experience. I'm not at all opposed to her idea. I just think, you know, like, I think we could all benefit, you know, from a time out from one another. What do you think about that? Just as an actual idea, you know, to promote.
Well, all the forced mixing is social engineering. I would say if you leave it to nature or to people's own, you know, preferences, they will segregate, and there's nothing inherently wrong with that, and they'll establish those areas where they want to integrate and mix and work together with, and that, and you know, absent coercion, you'll get a much healthier relationship, more honest and more productive, because even though some of those marginalized, groups, colored groups, if you will, if they're left to develop on their own without all the grievance, without the incursion of grievance, all this stuff, perhaps they'll establish their own elite and develop, which was occurring, you know, at one pace or another in the middle of the 20th century before, you know, you got the Great Society. It's hard to know what would have been if that hadn't happened. You can speculate, I guess.
Let me give you an example of creative segregation. I had dinner last night with a couple from Russia. Mm-hmm. Actually, she's not from Russia, but he is. And And so we were talking about the forthcoming Russia-China alliance and to what it would actually mean. And his take on it, he's Russian and he goes there, at least, of course, not now because he's afraid of ending up in the army. So he hasn't been there since the war broke out. But, he has close contacts and he's Russian. He grew up there. It's his culture, his life. And I said, well, how is this going to work out? And he goes, it's going to be terrific because he said there are a few Chinese businesses in like Moscow that he interacted with going back like 20 years. And he said, we just have so much to learn from them, these businesses. I said, really? He goes, yeah. He goes, in Russia, you know, if you want to get a business started, you just have constant, bombardment of bureaucratic procedure. Mm-hmm. He said, it's just, unless you're an oligarch, you know, little businesses just have to fight and just red tape. And he gave examples of some businesses he had that had been destroyed by bureaucracy. And he said, the people who can get through this are the Chinese because they have been basically fighting against, government bureaucracy for like 3,000 years. Mm-hmm. And he says the little business guys are absolutely expert at like thwarting the attempts by bureaucracy to stop them from making money. He said they just can figure ways out all over the place. And he said that this has actually been discussed at kind of the social level of, entrepreneurialism in Moscow, that this is going to be great. We can, if we actually have this rapprochement with China, we can bring in the small Chinese businessmen and let them destroy our bureaucrats, because this would be something be very useful for them and both sides would gain from it. So, mm-hmm. Integration isn't necessarily, bad. There are things that can occur, that might actually in some sense.
Did occur, but then there were boundaries.
Yeah.
And these things, and you didn't have, neighbors being forced to mix, kids being bussed from across town. Yeah,
that really worked out well, didn't it?
But they can be beaten up, that sort of thing. Yeah. That and also with the whole grievances industry feeding, the resentments and hatred and these things. It's interesting that Robin DiAngelo, I think she makes $30,000 a speech or something, or presentation.
Yeah.
A couple million a year, perhaps. But she wasn't canceled for this, of course, unlike Scott Adams, who lost publishing deals and contracts and syndication for saying a similar thing, perhaps kind of a similar reason, I guess you could say. So it's interesting to see the difference in reaction to the two proposals. But again, more of that nonsense. We see this at a lot of universities. I think there was Michigan College had announced that they're going to have 5 separate graduation celebrations separated by race, sexuality, gender identity, in addition to the larger commencement ceremony, which I guess would be the white one, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. We've seen this a lot of multiple. We've seen this separated graduations and organizations in colleges for years now. Blacks are allowed to have this, or if you're a sexual minority or one of these LGBTQ plus whatever groups, you can have organizations, you can have separate this and that, but there's no dedicated white ceremony, these things. And of course, this would conflict, you would think, with many laws in the state and also federal law, but they're nevertheless, they do this. Again, this is just sort of deny white people any valid identity, I guess. Not really to recognize any particular group. It's actually to deny the white graduates or students any sense of valid identity, at these institutions. So it's more ethnic cleansing, ethnic warfare stuff.
And it's the creation of the second class citizen, white person. I mean, the situation at Stanford Law School that came up last week was just fascinating, with Trina Steinbach, I think her name is, that she was the dean, and she's basically a dean of diversity.
Yeah, dean of diversity, yeah.
But I think that's actually what it functionally is. She's not an actual dean of the school, but she's like a diversity administrator or something. Anyway, and so, you know, they had that, they brought a conservative guy in, and the racial thugs shouted him down, and specifically they threatened him, and this is on tape. You know, anyone can, you can listen.
Was that Charlie Kirk?
I don't know, but who the guy was?
Yeah,
it'll come in a second. But mm-hmm. they were telling him, "We hope your daughters get raped." This was the actual. Hmm. Duncan. The Stanford Federalist Society invited Duncan, and he was going to give a speech. And so he took the stage, and then the thugs, you know, wouldn't let him talk. But they were specifically threatening him, and then telling him that they want his daughters to be raped. I mean, nice racial harmony. And so, so the diversity administrator Steinbach came in, and she said, "Well, I'm just deeply uncomfortable because many people here, your work has caused harm," and she kept using the fact that she's not comfortable with him. And so anyway, my point here is that when someone is threatened physically and his daughters are being threatened with rape, to come in and make a statement like that is really, it's like the mind of this individual has kind of stopped working. Think of the mind of this person, of how it is a woman. I think she's half Black, half Jewish, I believe. But, you know, she's obviously been coded and programmed to only respond in a certain way. But you would think that when you actually have, you know, which appears to be a pretty legitimate threat to rape the guy's daughter, mm-hmm. that are the hope for it, that you might come in and talk about how you're not comfortable with something that this person may or may not have done in his past, and so we have to talk about that first. It's just that it was such a classic example of how the mind of the people who make up the minions on the left have been completely ruined. They can't think at all.
Well, think about the caliber of the students that are there. These are the ones that are sitting.
Exactly right. And this is going, of course, you know, all of these.
And they have the implicit support of the school then when they say, you know.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so anyway, so it's these universities are just a complete, they're not just a waste of time and money. They are an absolute counterproductive part of anyone's life. And if anyone's out there with a kid who's thinking about going to Stanford or Harvard Law, just for God's sakes, steer them away from that. You know, there's other places, maybe just be very particular about the cultural environment, you know, and don't worry about the stature of the university degree, because it's all going to collapse anyway, right? I mean, obviously the Harvard and Yale and Stanford law schools are not going to be putting out, you know, anyone of intellectual significance, right? So what the heck? Forget about all that. Just this, these are just, you know, woke consciousness, racism awareness centers at this point. Just get out of there.
Yeah, the this is strange, but I'm surprised by it. Philadelphia reached a $9.25 million settlement with anti-police rioters. These are people who were rioting during the George Floyd Summer of Love 2020. Yeah. And apparently they sued for damages they suffered, harm they suffered, physical harm they suffered, or injuries they suffered while they were rioting in the city. And the city decided to pay them $9.25 million. City of Philadelphia agreed to pay $9.25 million to cover 200 rioters who claimed to have been injured by police during the Black Lives Matter riots of 2020. So why were they rioting?
I guess they're rioting so they could get money. I mean, this is just a clown world kind of situation. You had mentioned, you brought up the magic term busing earlier, and I was just thinking about how busing, it was a kind of double bind, you know, where they were taking the inner city youth into a really violent and sexually deranged place, right, with the Great Society programs and the crack cocaine and rap music. I mean, this was an intentional program to debase the African American. But at the same time, they were forcing them, busing them into the middle class, and then using critical theory against the middle class, saying, well, racism is your fault.
Yes. Right?
And so now if you're like with a white parent in like the 1970s and 80s, what are you going to do? It's just so you're dealing with just structures that are designed to make people crazy. You know, that's really what they are. And when you think about like the Philadelphia rioters suing because they were injured, well, gee, what about the city, the damage the city experienced? What about the small businesses?
Yes. And who do they sue? Yeah.
Yeah. So it is. And it's just wrong. I mean, it's obviously culturally wrong, but it's also double bind, you know, kind of stuff. It just, these sorts of things are just, they drive white people, they're made to drive white people crazy. It's like in San Francisco, they're trying to figure out the reparation for Black people, $5 million a person or something. Mm-hmm. And that's the first tranche. There'd be like additional revenues later on. I mean, I'm not sure it's even serious or it's even affordable, but as a concept, why would what is the purpose of this? You know, why would they even have such a thing as a meme? Well, they're just always working on our minds. You know, this is their eternal project, is to make us crazy, like they talk about in the authoritarian personality. And you know, this is also the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that one was like the Vietnam War. These regional conflicts they send us into. Don't you think that really one of the main reasons for them, I mean, other than the geopolitical protection of Israel or some other kind of oblique and malevolent purpose, is just to make sure that every generation has a large component of broken individuals, you know, World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, Iraq War. These wars shatter people, man. Oh man, you weren't there in the early 70s, thank heavens, when all of the Vietnam veterans who were just shattered, you know, and you'd see them, you could tell them really, because they'd been in such horror worlds that they never really recovered. You know, the suicide rates were spectacular among these people. And, you know, at the time we were opposed to war, you know, we had some idea, but the real thing was we were really looking at a project in my mind. They were just deliberately taking these kids into these jungles and letting them experience that so they would come back shattered and crazy.
Yeah, it is to drive you crazy. Police commissioner of Philadelphia is named Danielle Outlaw. Outlaw. Yeah. And she said she issued a statement saying, along with the city, state, and community stakeholders, we continue to work a nonstop towards improving what we as police do to protect the First Amendment rights of protesters, keep our communities and officers safe, and to ultimately prove that we are committed to higher standard. Now, I got the impression the police weren't particularly harsh or brutal with the protesters. They kind of let it happen. But this is, again, this is just the other to kind of drive everyone insane.
I mean, I'm sure you're going to tell me that she's been a big supporter of the 1-6 incarcerated, and she's trying to get them out, right? Because she's
because she wants to make sure you respect the rights of protesters, right?
Yeah, right. So I mean, can you show me the text where she's, you know, presenting the case why these people shouldn't be kept? You know.
Well, so New York police recently agreed to pay $7 million to roughly 300 rioters who police apparently got a little tough with. Again, if you look at what went on in New York, many of these cities, I got the impression that they weren't tough enough and there was a stand down. But again, they have, we also had this news of Donald Trump supposedly being, we've talked about this, news was he was going to be indicted. That didn't happen, of course, by this clown up in New York, DA Alvin Bragg, who is, of course, a Soros-funded DA.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
He's spending the resources of his office trying to get Donald Trump on this charge, where the city just collapses into anarchy. You go run through his record about, you know, having no bail, releasing violent felons, people getting raped, murdered, and robbed by repeat offenders, 18, 20 charges. Many of these people have priors and they're released. But he's obsessed with going after Donald Trump for headlines or whatever. Again, Soros, I think his organization donated $1 million to Alvin Bragg's successful DA campaign in Manhattan. I think he got close to 80% of the vote. The Gothamist reported that Color of Change PAC, a group that since 2016 has successfully backed reform-minded prosecutors across the country, from Philadelphia to Michigan to Atlanta. Oh, there's some great cities. Announced they're pitching $1 million through their political action committee to put towards mailers, canvassing, and phone banking on Bragg's behalf. The National Police Association accused Soros of funding ultra-leftist prosecutors like Alvin Bragg, Kim Fox, Larry Krasner, Philadelphia, George Gascon, Los Angeles, and of course, blamed for this has been blamed for the, at least partly for the explosion of crime in the past few years. Herndon, Virginia, there was a guy who randomly shot into a bar. Lucky he didn't hit anybody, fired his weapon, and he was later identified and arrested. And he was charged multiple felonies, but the district attorney has agreed to plea it out to a misdemeanor, so he'll be released. At least that's what the word is. Of course, the Commonwealth's attorney is Steve Descano, who is a Soros-funded prosecutor, DA. And again, this is how you just let these people out on the street. He was apparently he got $600,000 from Justice for Public Safety PAC, which is going to again a George Soros funded organization. So these prosecutors, again, we've talked about this in the past, that they're just dedicated to not enforcing the law, releasing violent felons onto the streets, and this watching the crime rates soar in these cities. You know, it's chaos. Yeah. That's what it is.
And they're driving out the police. I mean, New York City has had almost 4,000 cops quit or retire since the George Floyd mess. And the only time in its history that there even, I think, close was right after the 9/11 attacks, when so many of them were upset about, you know, the toxicity and stuff. But I mean, you can see that they're not ultimately, you know, these cities just aren't even viable. You know, it's kind of interesting when you think about it in the specific sense, like woke culture is just a very transitory phenomena because it doesn't have any generative power, right? I mean, there's not any families or children being produced, right? It can only exist as a culture, as an annex of heterosexual and, you know, kind of normal family production. So it doesn't have in and of itself anything other than one generation, and it's gone. And I would say that the same thing is true with the cities. I mean, you defund the police, you create $5 million reparation for your black citizens. Well, okay, how long will the city stay in existence? I mean, you know, these things will just be covered with vines, the buildings in like 50 years. Because there is, you don't have a kind of a natural, process that's going to go forward. It just can't last. The political activity of the Soros-funded DAs and mayors, and you know, coupled with like the woke consciousness, transgender, these things were 100% guaranteed to destroy a city within, what would you say, at the outside, 30 years at the most, you know, because you're not going to have any real police force, you're not going to have any, of course, no business. Who's going to come into that mess and invest? You know,
yeah.
So you're just going to have an exodus to the suburbs, and the suburbs are going to have to get more radical about how to keep trouble outside of their boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You mentioned, of course, this. We observed the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War, also often called the Second Persian Gulf War. This was a basically a war that consisted of two phases. The first was, of course, was the brief military conventional war fought through the spring of 2003, March through April, in which combined forces of U.S. troops and Great Britain and some other smaller contingents from other countries invaded Iraq and rapidly defeated the Iraqi military. And it was followed by a longer second phase, of course, in which the U.S. led an occupation of Iraq, which is much more problematic, and was opposed by an insurgency, Iraqis. After the violence began to decline in 2007, the United States gradually reduced its military presence and then completed formally, militarily withdrew from the country in December 2011. Of course, the war itself, the Iraq's invasion was set up years before, the Iraq invasion of Kuwait in 1990, which of course ended in Iraq's defeat by US-led coalition. This was called the Persian Gulf War. But the Ba'ath Party was able to stay in power. There wasn't an uprising against Saddam Hussein, and he managed to retain power, of course, suppressing the Kurds and the majority Shia Arabs. It's people remember that the Iraqi government under Saddam Hussein was Sunni. The vast majority of the country was Shia. To stem the exodus of Kurds from Iraq, the Allies established a safe haven in northern Iraq. This is sort of an autonomous Kurdish zone. This created problems. This was, I think, near the Turkish border, and the Turks have their own Kurdish problem, Kurdish separatists. It's a highly criminalized organization up there. In order contain Iraq aggression, the UN imposed much economic sanctions. These, of course, became infamous, perhaps leading to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children. These are sanctions prevented the country from, maintaining a water filtration system, getting much needed medicine and food. I think it was Madeleine Albright who declared it was worth it, that as many as 500,000 children had died as a consequence of these economic sanctions. Then there was always the UN inspections to check its weapons program, which became the pretext for the invasion in 2003, weapons of mass destruction. Of course, the whole, political environment that sort of created this war fever to invade Iraq in 2003, I remember it, was, of course, 9/11. And we can talk about the various lies, misconceptions, and propaganda that led to the war. But there was the belief that somehow Saddam Hussein was somehow tied to the conspirators of 9/11. And of course, we can talk about who the real conspirators are. But anyway, that's kind of the Iraq War. It ended in 2011. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of dead Iraqis, a country, sort of disintegrated and dissolved, destabilized. The whole region has been destabilized since then with the Arab Spring. We talked about diversity on these things, and perhaps this applies here because perhaps we could talk about the real motive of the Iraq War. Some people say it was oil, control of oil, control of the vast hydrocarbon reserves in the area. But perhaps there's another factor here. One is the Israeli angle and how the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and also the war in 1990 sort of conformed to various plans that the Israelis had developed in the 80s and 90s. One was the Oded Yanan plan, and they also the clean break by the same folks who gave us the Project for New American Century and Rebuilding America's Defenses, which called for a new Pearl Harbor, which we got with 9/11. So maybe we can talk about that dimension to this conflict. I'll let you take it from there.
The rationale to go in, I mean, people forget this, was the weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein was supposedly developing. And this was, obviously, I think, untrue. It's proven to be untrue, but they were making him out to be a dangerous and violent boogeyman. And he had committed the, what I think is the real crime in their eyes that caused the invasion, why he was set up, and I think he was deliberately set up to, he was encouraged to go into Kuwait. I mean, I think that's clear. And the reason they did that was so they could invade and depose in and put in a puppet regime. But this was because, you recall, he got into that skirmish with Israel, and he actually fired a Scud, mm-hmm. which landed, Scud missile, which landed inside of Israel. And people forget about this, but I think that was, you know, what, you know, I think that's when the planning, you know, started immediately at that point. That, you know, and the weapons of mass destruction that they were concerned about, obviously, was weapons of mass destruction that could be used against Israel. Because if something as trivial as a Scud missile could just come right on through and land somewhere, they were very secret about where the missile landed, because they didn't want, you know, any kind of calibration, you know, knowledge, as supposedly to make it more accurate. The second or third missile got that got fired, in case anyone did, any of them did, but it is absolutely certain that it landed somewhere in Israel. And so then this led to the whole weapons of mass destruction meme, which then was accumulated with Colin Powell's famous speech to the UN, which after the fact, he admitted he knew he was just lying his head off. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've seen his retractions. So it's the whole thing was ridiculous. I will say, I mean, it led to what I regard as the greatest sort of moment in that century for political comedy, though, and it was a failure. I mean, it didn't occur, but it's just been in my mind ever since I saw it. You recall he spoke to the United Nations, and he actually had the vial,
yes,
of the weapons of mass destruction. And I've always thought, you know, particularly since he knows he's lying, right? What he should have done is drop it. He should have drugged, oh my God, oh no. And then whipped out a gas mask and put it on. I mean, it was just a ludicrous performance. You could, if you look, and it's on the web. I mean, I would suggest people look at it, because you can really see how he knew he was lying. So the whole thing was, you know, it was kind of the basis, or, you know, sort of where we are with the color revolutions at this point, right? Where they talk about, you know, there's some reason why the regime is bad, but in this case it was that it was a threat to Israel, basically. And then we invade, we absolutely trash the country, like, you know, it's going on, for example, now with the Ukraine, or, you know, Syria, wouldn't you name it, wherever we, you know, we come in with the color revolution stuff. And we insert a puppet and leave that puppet to rule over a destroyed nation that would be too weak to be able to rise up and be a threat to anything. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, the, you know, you've seen the Saudi and Iran agreement that recently came about, you know, brokered by China. Well, there's two things which I think are going to be very interesting to see what happens following this complete debacle in the Ukraine. One is will any of the NATO member states leave because they can see that it's just too dangerous and unproductive to be part of NATO. And then the other thing is will the small oil producing countries get swept up, or will attempt to organize themselves in such a way to come under the umbrella of China, Russia? You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, for example, Somalia and Sudan, can they organize themselves to be allied with, you know, Iraq, which could then, you know, make a peace overture to Iran, and then all of them come as a package into the new world order that the Chinese would then give them military protection from? Because if that happens, then you would really have a complete cracking of the US petrodollar dominance, you know? And since the Iraq war, and it's not just, you know, we have the Iraq war as like the example of a trash nation. But remember, they've done the same thing to Syria, Lebanon. Think about Libya, for God's sakes, you mm-hmm. know. And then, of course, Somalia and the Sudan, well, all of which, as you know, I'm sure, were actually designated back in 2001. This is, what's his name, Clark?
Wesley Clark, yeah, seven nations or something.
Out of the meeting, the Pentagon, he said, look, they're going to attack Iraq first, and then you're going to go after Syria, Lebanon, Libya, you know, and the others. And essentially it happened. Iran is the only one that hasn't been actually invaded because they have a pretty strong army. So, I mean, if you were one of these little countries, wouldn't it now be sort of natural that you see Russia and China being able to stand up against the U.S. petrodollar dictatorship? Isn't it natural now for them to say, look, let's organize. Let's become, you know, a protected class underneath this new umbrella. And hopefully these guys will treat us a little bit better than the fascists that ran NATO.
Well, some people looked at the invasion of Iraq was done for the benefit of Israel, and Israel had pretty much taken over U.S. foreign policy at that point. This was done through the Office of Special Plans feeding of false intelligence to justify the invasion. And the Office of Special Plans was run by, was it Larry Franklin, I think was the guy who was caught spying for the Israelis, having daily, weekly briefings with Israeli military. To kind of set this whole thing up, feed the intel to like the New York Times, Washington Post, and they just pretty much reported Israeli propaganda as fact to the public. And of course, this is sort of just the only a few years after 9/11, all the hysteria about that, and we talk about, you know, it was the National Security Advisor to Bush. He said we don't want with the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud over, you know, one of our cities, implying Saddam Hussein was going to launch a nuclear weapon against the United States. Tony Blair saying that somehow London, you know, was in the sights of Baghdad or something. If we don't invade, it's just insane and these things. Of course, David Kelly? Didn't he, the scientist who ended up dying, committing suicide? He had... he's the one that had released, I think, exposed the false intelligence part of the British, and he just up dead in a park somewhere. That going on. So the U.S. invades, and again, this seems to comport with certain policy objectives that the Israelis had laid out for 20 years. One would be the Oded Yinyan plan. He is a high-ranking Israeli foreign official in the foreign ministry. Israeli official in the foreign ministry. He was close to ties to Ariel Sharon, and basically, it set out an agenda that had remarkable resemblance to what would occur in the Middle East in the next 20 years. One thing is, Israel would work to destabilize neighboring countries, to break the larger countries like Syria, Iraq, Libya into little statelets so they could no longer pose a real threat to Israeli security, and also to create a refugee crisis. Again, we've seen this with these conflicts. You saw that with the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, then you had the Arab Spring, and you had what happened in Libya, and what's going on in Syria right now with the U.S. supporting a civil war, supporting Islamic fundamentalists against the secular Syrian government, the Assad regime. So pretty much supporting a civil war since 2011 or 12, which isn't really in the headlines. We have troops and I guess contractors there occupying Syrian territory, stealing their natural gas and oil. But this seems to what occurred. Then you also have the clean break plan, which was written by the same people who would write Rebuilding America's Defenses, the Project for New American Century's plan for the U.S. in the 21st century, which somehow was able to come about because of 9/11. And what occurred on 9/11, the attacks in New York and Washington, D.C. But yeah, this report is a clean break, a new strategy for securing the realm, was prepared in 1996 by a study group led by Richard Perle. Others like Douglas Feith, who's another one who was involved in the run-up to the Iraq war. David Wormser, Mayor of Wormser. These are all American Jews writing a report for the Israeli government. And again, the clean break, what you saw the Iraq war, or it was a disaster for the United States, and for Iraq, of course, appeared to achieve these objectives that laid out in the clean break for Israel. So what we have here, we have, again, a pattern here, where U.S. foreign policy, although packaged as going after terrorists and fighting the war on terror and, imposing a rules-based system, is carrying out policies all for the benefit of little Israel. So that is interesting.
Right. I mean, the neocons, before they were neocons, you know, people like William Crystal and William Simon, if I recall, what's his name, Poteretz, these guys.
Yeah, Potter, yeah.
Yeah, they
Norman
were.
Norman Poteretz and then his son.
Yeah, now, before they become proponents of this controlling the world by the U.S., they were all basically just lobbyists for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And really, when you look at Wesley Clark's, understanding of this project, you know, that they have, that they've been working on, you know, and how they're going to take out all these Muslim nations. I mean, this is just a kind of dressed up and given a false purpose for its, you know, for why we'd want to do it, of these original ideas that go back, you know, all the way into, the 1960s and the Israeli war with Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, after that, you really had the foundation of the neoconservative movement. It wasn't called that. It wasn't even involved at originally with the U.S. foreign policy, but it's all these same guys. That's why it's so important to like study them as dual citizens.
Yeah, they seem to have kind of wormed their way into it with the Reagan administration.
Yeah, they did.
In the 80s.
And so once they got in, then they obviously took over the foreign policy. They did it incrementally. But when you get to the acting out of the insanity that Clark describes when he was in the Pentagon, you know, being described in 2001, that was the result of like 25 years of planning by these guys.
Yeah, you have the conference, the on terrorism in Jerusalem in 1979.
Yep.
It was.
Yeah.
Planning all this out, and this because they were planning sort of the phasing out of the Cold War at that point.
Right. You know, I think it's really important for people to study that. And I wish it's not something you're ever going to get in the university, but something that anyone who's linked up to the independent media can easily do. You know, you can get a lot of foundational material so you can see how the project for the new American century and the neoconservative movement was not just somehow, you know, magically brought in, you know, to existence, you know, and in 1995. I mean, it had been in different iterations going on for 25 years. And it was always designed as a way to protect Israel by destroying the Muslim nations around it.
Mm-hmm.
And weakening them, making them into failed states, you know, refugee crisis. I mean, you look at these countries now, you know, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, even Somalia and Sudan. I mean, they had trouble, those two nations, but everyone in Africa was having trouble post-colonialism, and they are all been trashed,
mm-hmm.
just absolutely trashed, you know, every single nation. So this is sort of a, you know, it's kind of a template, you know, in this case, they identified the Muslim nations around Israel that might be in any way a danger, and then they deliberately went out and destroyed them, and then they gave it a philosophy of the American century, the indispensable nation. Somehow we were trying to bring democracy. I mean, you know, how long will the sophistry and the ludicrous cover story that these genocidal maniacs give us be taken seriously and used politically against us? You know, when you think about the Ukrainian situation, right? I mean, Tim, here is a nation that has been destroyed, literally 40 million person nation that has been destroyed. And they are going to say, we were there to try to help it, try to protect it, and it just accidentally got destroyed. We're so sorry. Mm-hmm. We're trying to help the Iraqi people. There's a brutal dictator. We're trying to help Syria. The Hezbollah, look, they are just out to genocide whichever peoples they need to get rid of in order to create a world in which they have all the political power, and then they will be happy. This is what the goal is. And of course, they can't ever say that. This is the true quiet part. This is the part that cannot be said out loud. But this is the only thing that can explain all of these different weird military and genocidal events that the U.S. has been involved with since the Vietnam, well, since World War I, but specifically in terms of the neocon since, the year 2000.
Yeah, I think the critical year is 1967. You kind of alluded to it with the Six-Day War, and the sort of the Jewish ascendancy since the late 1970s, and of course the infiltration of neocons into the Reagan administration. These were Jews, of course, dominating, sort of taking over foreign policy. And again, it is kind of a cover story. You talk about Pax Americana, sort of seeing the American empire. And there is some truth to that, because for the longest time, the WASP establishment kind of ran the show and the Jews were the junior partners. And apparently after the late 70s, the tail began to wag the dog, so to speak. And we've had sort of this transition, and we've the takeover of things like the Council of Foreign Relations by Jews. It's dominated by Jews now. This was a WASP establishment. Now, if you look at it, it's dominated by Jews, and who have a strong, of course, attachment, or they identify with Israel. And the whole foreign policy establishment has been taken over. State Department, key offices like the Sanctions Office, the Treasury, things taken over by Zionist Jews who use it for that purpose. And that's something that people have a hard time identifying, because they're not supposed to think in that category, is that the American empire at one time wasn't necessarily Jewish. Now it's become increasingly Jewish in the latter half of the 20th century and the 21st century. We see this sort of with the Iraq war, blaming it on, again, American imperialists, oil companies, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld. Even with 9/11, I remember when I was first kind of reading about it, kind of looking into it, maybe 2007, 2008, kind of really started to think about it. I remember coming across someone like Webster Tarpley, who would talk about 9/11. He emphasized neocon fascist madmen who carried out the 9/11 attacks. He went on to say the most important thing is that 9/11 myth is the premise that the root of Afghanistan war and the Iraq war and the coming attack on Iran, we must deprive the myth perpetrators' ability to stampede and manipulate hundreds of millions of people with their cynically planned terrorist events. Neocon fascist madmen, he said. Well, Paul Wolfowitz, Pearl, Wormser, Feith, Netanyahu, they're all Jews. And yeah. So I'm thinking, wait a second. So something's going on here. That's a cover story. And so we're all talking about 9/11 truth, this and that. But then again, a lot of that was very abstract. When you started researching it, then we have, of course, this whole thing with the Project for New American Century, the New Pearl Harbor. What do they all have in common? Well, this is serving the interest of Zionism and the Israeli state and Jewish interests. And same thing with the current war in the Ukraine, is it's serving the interests of Jewish oligarchs and billionaires and Israel. And that's, again, another angle we're not supposed to think about. But if you look at it, all the participants, like in the war with between Russia and Ukraine, who fomented it? Well, it was the U.S. did it. And of course, if you look at the current government in Ukraine that the U.S. installed in 2014, it's run by Jews. Of course, the people who did it for the U.S. government were Jews. Victoria Nuland, right? Installing, was Poroshenko, and then eventually getting to Zelensky, who was just a tool for Igor Kolomensky, who was a Jewish oligarch, who's robbed the country blind.
You know? Yeah, I mean, I think for perspective on how like the neocon movement is completely a Israeli lobby, basically, inside the United States. You probably would want to go back and read about the American Enterprise Institute, which is where Kristol, you know, developed a lot of these ideas. And then he went in, he became a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. You're talking about when it was taken over. This was when it was taken over. This was in the early 70s. But they have different names for the organizations, and there's different boogeymans that they try to get you to be afraid of. But I've used the expression in the past that the intellectual DNA of these groups, if you look at that, you'll see that it's always the same through time. It's always, they're always pro-Israeli. They're always pro central, banking with fiat currency. And they're always for destruction of Europe and Islamic nations, wherever they can possibly get their hands on them. In kind of strand of sort of clarification that I've been looking at recently is this guy, Ivan Kachanowski. He's a Ukrainian professor of history, Ukrainian history, and intellectual. And he's done all this research into the actual Maidan rebellion, which led to, you know, Zelensky's being a president. I highly recommend people attend his website and read his material, because he just shows without any confusion whatsoever how clear-cut the rebellion was artificial, how it was designed basically by the Jewish oligarchs. I mean, you can't really name them, but you know, that would be the next, you know, it's Molininsky, and it all leads up to Zelensky and Newland. But when you see how artificial that was, when you see how easy it is to see that the whole premise for getting rid of Yanukovych, who was the democratically elected Ukrainian president, this is, I think, a template for understanding, you know, what led up to the Iraq War. I really see the Iraq War and the Ukrainian War with a very much kind of a parallel, hidden agenda that's creating these conflicts. You know, it just happens time and time again. And in Kachanowski's case, he's had papers, and they're, you know, he's like a scientist. He's putting out this stuff. He can't get any of it put into the media. Nothing. They will not publish a single one of his papers. And because they can't, you know, again, we've pushed them to the point of diminishing returns where they cannot engage us. All they can do is censor. So, you know, with now we have the 20th anniversary of the Iraq War. And it's interesting, you know, time just sort of takes away the urgency of these things, right? Where because the conflict ends and then you have the trash nation, but people should know and try to go back and understand that history better as to how we actually got in it. Because believe me, it's always, so often it's the same, you know, group that is benefiting from a chaotic, destroyed nation, that they will find a way to pick up the pieces or defend Israel or have financial gain. And they're always hiding behind these rationales, you know, of, well, it's a dangerous dictator. Putin is invading. He has, you know, world conquering ambitions. We have to stop him or he'll become another. There's all these absurd positions, you know, that they give to confuse us. But if you just study them sequentially and look at them one at a time and see the different groups and the intellectual structure being very, very similar in all of them that are promoting these conflicts, you come to, I think, a much clearer point of understanding of what we've experienced over the last 100 years. Iraq War was just one of the many deliberately destroyed nations that is, you know, benefiting neoconservative world domination goal.
You know, I understand how this is done. Is it's how they take over foreign policy. Is, well, one thing is they install, you know, agents within the various bureaucracies, assistant secretary, assistant secretaries at the, you know, the State Department and the Pentagon. We saw that, you know, of course, around the Iraq War, you know, with the Office of Special Plans, but also the creation, you mentioned some of these think tanks. There's a constellation of think tanks and organizations that are funded by, you know, Sheldon Adelson. I think when he was alive, he was pretty much wrote, you know, paid for the American Enterprise Institute. And there's Bernard Marcus and Paul Singer, two other Jewish oligarchs who donate heavily. Yeah. Manhattan Institute. There's what the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, American Enterprise Institute. You mentioned that the Middle East. The Middle East Media Research Institute, the Institute for Study of War, and they produce all these papers. And but they're all institutes that are tied to Jewish billionaires who are who are basically loyal to Israel, and they're the ones that are providing not the intelligence but the narrative that support these wars, continuing these wars, the neoconservative wars, if you will. And of course these are all Jewish organizations, Jewish dominant organizations. There wasn't for the longest time the United States never appointed a Jewish ambassador to Israel. I thought it was a conflict of interest. And it was Martin Indyk, I think, was the first Jew who became the ambassador to Israel. Mm-hmm. Bill Clinton did that. He wasn't even a U.S. citizen. He was the U.S. ambassador to Israel, but he wasn't a U.S. citizen. You know, how does that work? But it was considered a conflict of interest. And the problem with this is this speaks to someone in that position who's Jewish. They're not constitutionally able of representing the United States. They're dedicated to representing their people first. And this is just something that speaks to the Jewish identity, which they write about themselves. They're people that should dwell alone. They're a separate group. They have their own interests. They'll say that in another context, but then if you look at something like the development of foreign policy and you question, you know, wait a second, should you be trusted in developing policy if you are indeed Jewish and you have a loyalty to Israel? Isn't that a conflict of interest? Then they call you an anti-Semite, of course. But at the very least, there should be sort of people who are Jewish should recuse themselves or should not be given positions with policies or questions in regard to vis-a-vis to Israel, because it's a conflict of interest. And we've seen that play out throughout history. Even in positions of power, this is something that the ideology of Zionism creates, because by creating a Jewish state, a sovereign state, theoretically, in which all Jews are citizens, claim citizenship or can become citizens or can hold citizenship, to say them hold positions of cultural, political, economic power in foreign countries, it's a conflict of interest. And it is a unique problem, which again, given the narrative, or at least given our political rhetoric, or given the control that our current Sanhedrin have over American culture, political discourse, we can't question it all, because we'd be accused of anti-Semitism, which is the cardinal sin, of the modern world. You cannot.
Yeah, and it's funny, isn't it? Because the fact that we can't think about or talk about it just shows you how it is absolutely essential to think and talk about it.
Yes.
And if we had in just normal, polite, civilized vernacular, a process wherein Jewish political position holder in the United States was analyzed for conflict of interest, right? That would just be a normal, let's just like look through this. The conflict would become so overwhelming so fast to any clear-minded person that it would put a stop to the use of the U.S. as basically a proxy. I mean, as I would see the world now, you know, you have these proxy wars like, the Ukraine, which is really just NATO against Russia. Well, the whole, Pax Americana is just a proxy war against the world by Israel, in my mind. It's their control over us, and they're hiding behind us you know, because they are able, which makes them so much more effective at, you know, coming up with fake narratives and things to confuse people, because we don't know that we're being manipulated. But if Americans just had that, you know, basic way of looking at the world, of just, you know, these guys are so well organized. Look at all of the thousands of organizations that are strictly Jewish, mm-hmm. right? Which is in defiance of the idea of the woke consciousness of enforced multiculturalism, multi-ethnic. Well, where you have restricted ethnicity is inside these Jewish organizations, which have enormous political power. To say enormous, I mean, they basically have absolute political power. There's, you know, it's like you go into the transgender movement and you look in back of it and you see a half a dozen Jewish organizations that are promoting it. And then you look inside those organizations and there's just no Gentiles, right? They just have so they have ethnic separatism inside of which they can do analysis for their own self-interest without the concern of being called racist by the people, you know, who they're going to be operating against, because we don't get to see the you know, how they structure their ideas. And you know, it's like the letters of the Zionists concerning how they were going to expose the Palestinians, you know, Golda Meir and Nachum Begin and these guys. You know, they had a letter exchange which Noor Messallah brought out. It is an incredibly important book, you know, The Expulsion of the Palestinians. Well, when you see how they communicate and how absolutely genocidal and racist they are among themselves, right? And just see how casually they talk about, you know, using violence against these people and how they're just animals and so. Well, isn't it natural to wonder if this isn't the same perspective inside all of these other organizations that these people maintain, right? I mean, isn't that just a normal, ordinary question to have? Mm-hmm. So why can't we have it? Why can't we, when you have an organization like the ones that are promoting transgenderism, right, that are strictly Jewish, why can't we do an analysis of the potential that they are basically creating social policy for the purpose of harm to European and Christian culture? What is wrong with that? You know, and what's wrong with it is just that we will be attacked. They control the media, so then they can bring the intimidation against us, so we can't think clearly. And you know, they can even cancel us at this point. You know, canceled by woke consciousness groups, which are promoting enforced, you know, multi-ethnic clusters, who are being manipulated by Jewish organizations that wouldn't let any of these people anywhere near them.
Antifa, Black Lives Matter, and yeah.
Yeah, you know.
So anyway, look at Susan Rosenberg, where she gets a pardon. She set a bomb off in the Senate bill. She gets a pardon at the behest of a congressman from New York. He lobbied for the Jewish congressman. And she's on the board of, I think, of a group that funds Black Lives Matter, funnels money probably for George Soros and the Black Lives Matter. But then you have the January 6th protesters. The Merrick Garland's Justice Department is seeking to prosecute 1,000 more people. Who never even set foot in the Capitol, just being down there. And that, and that's just okay. It's fine. That type of abuse, and yeah, it's
and well, you're so aggressive.
Yeah,
you know, the attacks on Christians and Europeans were, you know, carefully structured and camouflaged, you know, in the last 50 years. But now with Merrick Garland, you have a new level, a new clarity. You know, they're just, you know, they're just going after them because they're the group that supports MAGA, which is dog whistle for Make America White Again, which of course, you know, is not something that is even really held in, you know, in high regard by a lot of these people, but it's just a way of, you know, we're just a racist group of people, you know, critical theory, everything about us is no, wrong.
Increasingly, all these like ATF or FBI, and sort of these these Czechist organizations they become more Czechist under Merrick Garland, surprise surprise, is they've hired a lot of affirmative action people, a lot of degenerates, lesbians, people who have nothing, have contempt for sort of heritage America, normal Americans that kind of make society work. So when you're shocked when someone, like a normal person is victimized, Mark Houck, right? And he's there at church and there's 6 or 7 kids. And why would you go after these people? Well, look at that family. They're healthy. That's why they go after those people. And that's how you have to look at, Merrick Garland and his FBI. And if you look at the type of people who prosecuted Mark Houck. I read an interesting article in Culture Wars about that. And a guy who actually went to the trial and watched some of the FBI agents and prosecutors involved in it and what they looked like and their demeanor. A lot of bitter women in pantsuits, as the article talked about. And so these are the type of people who they don't have temperament or the integrity to be entrusted with any power. But that's why they're hired.
Giving them power is just shooting yourself in the head. Mm-hmm. Because at this point, it's sort of like the Great Society programs. At this point, there should be clarity, right, as to what the effect will be. You did a great interview with E. Michael Jones last week I was listening to, where he just talks about what happens when you let people who are aligned with Jewish interests have political power. And, he gave kind of a historical overview. And at this point, you can just assume that their centrifugal, energy of Jewishness will be what animates them.
Yes.
When they go out to get the votes of Europeans, they will have another story about what they represent. But then as soon as the power is given to them, man, it's just axiomatic that the energy that is really inside them, is not woke consciousness or transgender. I mean, unless those things are ways that they can shatter European culture, but they are really always looking out for themselves. They really are just very selfish, self-centered, and you can just be certain of it. So, if you feel like you can't talk about this with people, well, you need to do a little bit of personal growth, right?
Well, that's the problem is you can't talk to someone whose first sentence is, as Michael Jones says, who's always, I have relatives who died in the Holocaust. Shut up, Gory.
Yes.
And that's their attitude. I was reading an article today about there is a performance of The Merchant of Venice being performed by the Shakespearean Society in London. But it's adapted to take place in 1936 England. And the guy with the article, Andrew Joyce, who is by the name Andrew Joyce, I think he's wrote the article, talking about, what The Merchant of Venice really is about. It's about avarice and greed among all the parties in the play. But because it features Shylock and it talks about pound of flesh and these things, the Jewish interpretation is obsessed that it's anti-Semitic. Well, broadly, if you read the play, it's about, Antonio worrying about his riches, and he's in church worrying about his ships that haven't come in, and it's this guy who needs money so he can marry a rich princess and these things. So it's everybody. So Shakespeare's kind of commenting on everybody, in society, sort of a corrupt Venetian state, right? The Venice, the traders, money, the power of money, the corruption of money. But to the Jews, it's only anti-Semitic because in many ways, a negative treatment of a Jewish character.
Yeah.
The character does kind of talk about him. So he talks about the way he's been treated. So you can say there's some empathy there. If you prick me, do I not bleed? But to the Jews, it's just anti-Semitic and has to be.
That is actually very important insight. And it's funny. I mean, I wrote extensively about The Merchant of Venice in my book, Shakespeare's Secret Messiah. So you can see that, I won't disagree with your position there.
But the point is, if you're any way critical of Jews or of a Jew, it's not a criticism, it's anti-Semitism, and it's pathological, it's illegal, it should be illegal, you need to be canceled for it. Yeah, critical,
What they've been able to do is, is they can take the, at this point, the normal conflict of different groups having different self-interests,
mm-hmm.
and they can characterize your desire to resist their, what amounts to sophistry or self-interest, however you want to characterize it. They are able to criticize you as being anti-Semitic. It's really just an extension of, of the authoritarian personality, but also, you know, which becomes critical theory. I mean, the critical theory would be another aspect of like how they organize themselves against this. But this is just, you know, it's a very clever, psychologically powerful kind of sophistry, wherein if we just are being ourselves and wanting to have our political power and our self-interest and our ethnicity, that these things are not, you can't even discuss them because they're anti-Semitic.
Yes.
They've actually been able to twist, you know, kind of psychology and reason to the point where just someone who says, you know, I really don't like the idea of, a college professor, you know, having such a weird idea about European history. I want to stop that. I want to get together with like the Europeans here on the campus and have a special organization that we would, you know, try to think about how to defend ourselves. I mean, that would be attacked as fascism.
Yes, not wanting drag queens to groom kids at libraries during Drag Queen Story Hour is hate. It's hate. It's bigotry.
Yeah, critical theory gone run amok. And if you understand the context of the ideas, they're a lot easier to defend yourself against. I mean, I think the independent media is doing a good job of, you know, getting the history of the assault against Christian culture to the minds of everyone. And this will hopefully shatter some of the power of, the concepts, Holocaust denial, anti-Semitism, racism, you know, these things, so that we can start thinking again, you know, a little bit and defend ourselves.
Well, you see that with the Clean Break document and the Odanian plan, whereas the position of Israel vis-a-vis her neighbors isn't to say, well, maybe our neighbors have some legitimate security interests, maybe the people there have some legitimate grievances, let's work this out diplomatically. It's so let's smash them, destroy their nation states, undermine their societies, engulf them in civil wars, create a refugee crisis, and just destroy them, their ability to organize and coalesce and deal with us in any organized fashion. So they're weak. Yeah, we create hell on earth for everybody around us, but it adds to our security. Oh boy, what's that? You know, don't we see that all around us now in the West?
Yeah, literally what you've described there is Israel is functioning as one of the secret society, you can call them that, Jewish organizations in America that then promote politically destructive to European programs here. Mm-hmm. Right? It's the same thing.
It's completely neurotic, and it's ultimately self-destructive. Neurotic,
and it's also contradictory because remember the whole idea of the integration that they're trying to create. Well, there's no integration inside any of these Jewish organizations that are promoting transgenderism, and there sure isn't any integration inside of Israel.
No,
right, to any real extent. So come on. I mean, I have discussions with Jewish people all the time, and I really have a hard time taking them seriously because their intellectual position is so contradictory, and it's really comical at this point. I mean, you know, after the war, before the details of the Holocaust, you know, were really, I think, clarified, there was certainly, you know, a period of time when, you know, everyone was concerned about the horror of what had occurred to Jews during World War II. So that was a defense against the fact that they were going to genocide the Palestinians, right,
mm-hmm.
in 1950. But I think, hasn't it by now? I mean, haven't we gone through enough of these destructions? I mean, You know, the Syrians certainly aren't deserving of what happened to them. The Iraqis aren't deserving of what happened to them. I mean, Libya, that's just heartbreaking when you see how shattered they've made that country. So, you know, I mean, it's just a very longstanding and clear agenda. And the only way that it can ever stop is if people have the, you know, are able to stand up, you know, clearly against it. And you can't stand up against it if you can't describe it, talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, he said, you know who rules over you, just see you're not allowed to criticize.
Yep.
So, okay, Joe.
All right, brother. Well, good talking to you. We'll get him again next week.
Take it easy. Put the pollen washers away. So.
Yeah, well, God, me too. I mean, my eyes are swollen shut here.
Feel better. Take it easy.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.